Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, this is a History of Europe Key Battles podcast. The Anglo-Dutch Wars, 1652 to 1674, part 2 of 4. As the events in Europe become ever more closely linked to those across the globe, I'd like to give a brief shout out to a new podcast which is covering the history of North America. I'll let the host, Mark Vinette, say a few words about it.
The History of North America podcast is a sweeping historical saga of the United States, Canada, and Mexico from their deep origins to our present epoch. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this exciting, fascinating, epic journey through time, focusing on the compelling, wonderful, and tragic stories of North America's inhabitants, heroes, villains, leaders, environment, and geography. This incredible historical adventure follows a path of exciting events led by interesting people who reach beyond their grasp to touch key moments in time. The History of North America podcast series is an educational and entertaining look at the thrilling chronicle of North America, an action-packed tale of a continent that is still unfolding. I invite you to come along for the ride.
I encourage you to check out Mark's podcast. But for now, back to Europe. The Anglo-Dutch Wars of the 17th century have left little impression on the national consciousness of Britain, and indeed little impression outside of the Netherlands. British naval historians are more frequently attracted to past wars against France or Germany. A possible explanation offered by J.R. Jones is that the Anglo-Dutch Wars don't fit into the traditional historical narrative of the Briton working to maintain a balance of power in Europe, resisting the would-be hegemons of Louis XIV, Napoleon or Germany under Wilhelm II or Hitler. Yet the Anglo-Dutch Wars were not only important events in their own right, but were the earliest in a sequence of oceanic sailing ship wars that continued up until 1815. The Dutch Republic was the youngest state of mid-17th century Western Europe, having recently asserted its independence from Spain. It consisted of 7 provinces: Gelders, Holland, Zeeland, Utrecht, Overijssel, Frisia, and Groningen. The main federal institution was the Estates General, a small assembly of 24 deputies who met in The Hague, were mostly concerned with finance, foreign relations, and military affairs. In addition, each province had their own executive body headed by a senior officer, the stadtholder. The House of Orange, a leading Dutch family, held most of the stadtholderates. When its head, Frederick Hendrik, died in 1647, they passed on to his son, William II. There existed a tension between the House of Orange, who thought in federal terms, and local provincial leaders, especially the leader of the largest province, Holland, whose title was the Grand Pensionary. Holland, whose population was about 670,000, or 45% left of the whole republic, was one of the most economically dynamic regions of Europe. And since its citizens contributed over half the finances required by the federal bodies, they normally held primacy in military affairs. Because Holland had no rival in the republic, it was capable of holding all else together, even though the poorer provinces not infrequently resented its ascendancy. Also, not all provinces were the same culturally. While Holland and Zeeland were predominantly urban and led by a middle-class merchant class, in the landward provinces, aristocrats and landed gentry retained influence. William II regarded the peace of 1648 as a betrayal of its best interests and placed the blame on Holland. The leadership of Holland in return suspected William of having monarchic ambitions. Those suspicions were heightened when William gave shelter to his son-in-law, Charles II, the son of the executed King Charles I of England. William also played upon the execution of Charles I to propagate anti-republican sentiments. The dispute between William and Holland centred on the army, since Holland, which had always carried the main burden of war, believed that peace should lessen the tax burden and wanted to reduce the Republic's armed forces. Other provinces protested, and William decided upon drastic action. In July 1650, he arrested six deputies of Holland and marched with a sizeable army on Amsterdam. He failed to enter the city, but the threat of violence was enough to persuade Holland to give up its plans to reduce the size of the military. The States General opposed Holland's arbitrary decision to downsize the military, but they also resisted William's plans to resume war with Spain in the autumn of 1650. Whether William could have got his way is unknown, because he died of smallpox that November at the age of just 24. His death opened the way for a new solution to the constitutional problem, as Holland simply abolished the position of stadtholder. This was made easier by the fact that William's only son, also called William, was born a week after his death. When he grew up, William III was to play an important role in future events, but for now the Dutch entered a period known to historians as the First Stadtholderless Era, the era without a stadtholder. The most influential figure in the Republic became Johan de Witt, who came from a prominent family and worked as a lawyer in The Hague before being appointed to the position of Grand Pensionary of Holland. De Witt always had to act with circumspection. Holland may have dominated the Republic, but the other provinces' sovereignty could not be compromised, and Holland needed their votes in the Estates General. In March 1649, after the execution of Charles I, the Commonwealth made an approach to the Dutch for good relations, floating the idea of a permanent and close alliance. Holland alone, among the provinces, argued for recognition of the Commonwealth, but William II's support for Charles II made this impossible. Only after his death in November was recognition at last given to Cromwell's Commonwealth. William's death seemed to transform the situation. London sent diplomats to offer the States General a union or coalition between the two republics. However, in making this offer, the English were naively unaware of very real differences between the two states. Firstly, the influential Dutch Reformed Church were strong supporters of the House of Orange and denounced the execution of Charles. Secondly, the Dutch were wary that too close an alignment of the regicide Commonwealth could potentially provoke hostilities with other states. And thirdly, while in a Dutch federal system each province retained sovereignty, the government in London adopted a system of political centralisation. The Dutch saw how Scotland and Ireland were being forcibly incorporated into a unitary state controlled from London and didn't want to risk any chance of that happening to themselves. At the same time, as the negotiations were taking place, the English were increasingly unhappy about their merchants being overwhelmed by Dutch shipping, especially after lifting of an embargo on trade between the Spanish Empire and the Dutch Republic. English direct trade was crowded out by a sudden influx of commodities from the Levant, Mediterranean, and the Spanish and Portuguese empires. Impatient at the lack of progress with negotiations, in 1651 the English Parliament passed the Navigation Act. The aim was to exclude the Dutch and other foreign merchants from the carrying trade, with sanctions backed up by naval force. Only ships with an English owner, master, and a majority English crew would be accepted. It allowed European ships to import their own products, but banned foreign ships from transporting goods to England from a third country elsewhere in the European sphere. Breaking the terms of the Act would result in the forfeiture of the ship and its cargo. These rules specifically targeted the Dutch, who controlled much of Europe's international trade and even much of England's coastal shipping. The Dutch responded by enlisting large numbers of armed merchantmen into their navy. The English then, trying to revive an ancient right they perceived they had, demanded that other ships strike their flags in salute to their ships. On the 29th of May, 1652, Lieutenant Admiral Martin Tromp refused to show the respectful haste expected in lowering his flag to salute an English fleet. This resulted in a skirmish, the Battle of Goodwin Sands, after which the Commonwealth declared war on the Netherlands on the 10th of July. All the major engagements were fought in a very limited area, the North Sea from the southern edge of the Dogger Bank to the Straits of Dover, and mainly in the first of the Anglo-Dutch Wars, in the English Channel. During the conflict, trading vessels had to pass through the same narrow seas in which the naval operations were taking place. Even in such a compact area, it was still easy for opposing fleets to miss each other, frustrated by gales or poor visibility. The physical characteristics of the area played an important role. Whereas for land battles, local geography such as hills and rivers often played a crucial role, sea battles were influenced by winds, tides, shoals and coastal geography. The weather was also often particularly important, especially because the 17th century fell within a little ice age, where storms were more frequent and often fiercer. At sea, storms could easily end up inflicting more damage than battle, and prolonged bad weather frequently disrupted operational plans. A feature of the North Sea is that it is generally very shallow, often about 80 to 120 feet. This made anchoring in the open sea feasible with mostly good holding ground, mud, sand and shingle. Its numerous shoals or sandbars greatly influenced naval operations as they posed dangers to unwary sailors, especially in larger ships. Some shoals near an estuary such as the Thames dry out at low tide. More dangerous are those such as the Kentish Knock or the Gabbards, well out of sight of land and lying from north to south across the direct line between the Thames and the Dutch coast. In wartime, the rudimentary navigational aids used to mark their location, such as poles, were often removed or not replaced after being dislodged by storms. In more southern waters, the Dutch were adept at using local knowledge of shoals to their advantage, sometimes using channels behind or between shoals as a safe refuge. The British naval commanders, Blake and Monk, compared this Dutch practice to the Highlanders taking to the Scottish mountains to escape pursuit. Knowledge of local havens or good anchorage points was also very valuable. On the English side, an area called the Downs provided strategic anchorage between the Kent coast and the treacherous Goodwin Sands to the east. As long as the weather held up, a fleet stationed there could block the Dover Straits or sail quickly to either the North Sea or English Channel.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
At the onset of war, the Dutch felt confident. The reputation of the English Navy had plummeted during the reigns of the first Stuart kings and the Civil War. However, geography favoured the English. While they enjoyed a long coastline, the Dutch lacked ready access to the oceans, with the British Isles, as one Dutch skipper put it, at the beginning of the First War, standing across from the North Sea like an eagle with its wings outstretched. The English also had the advantage of being self-sufficient in food, and although she depended on naval materials such as timber and tar from the Baltic, the need for these would only become pressing in the event of a prolonged conflict. The Dutch, on the other hand, would have to rely on their trade revenues to finance the war. Neither side began with a particularly coherent strategy. While the English fleets attacked merchant shipping, the Dutch focused on escorting convoys. Early on, the English made the mistake of splitting their forces. Navy Commander Blake was sent into the northern North Sea to attack homeward-bound Dutch vessels. His objective was the Dutch fishing fleet, then off the Shetland Islands, whose activity in the British seas were a long-standing cause of resentment. This left Commander George Askew with a weaker force in the Dover Straits. The senior commander of the Dutch was Admiral Martin Tromp, generally seen as the foremost naval commander of the age. Born in 1598, Tromp had a long career, including campaigns against the corsairs and privateers and against the Spanish, most famously the Battle of the Downs in October 1639. He was a strong supporter of the Orange Party and sympathised with the royal cause during the English Civil War. Tromp should probably have taken on the weaker force of Askew, but instead followed Blake where the northern seas, bad weather, prevented an engagement. His fleet narrowly escaped being driven onto the rocks of Shetland. The States General also split their forces, sending Commander Michael de Ruyter to escort a convoy down the channel. On the 12th of July 1652, they were intercepted by a fleet of George Askew. Askew attempted to attack the convoy with around 9 of his strongest and fastest warships, but de Ruyter counter-attacked and in the Battle of Plymouth surrounded the English warships. Each side suffered heavy casualties in personnel, but no ships were lost. The next major battle occurred at Kentish Knock on the 8th of October, 1652. The Dutch attacked the English fleet near the mouth of the River Thames, but were beaten back with many casualties. The English Parliament, believing the Dutch to be near defeat, sent away 20 ships to strengthen the position in the Mediterranean. This division of forces left Blake with only 42 men of war by November, while the Dutch were making every effort to reinforce their fleet. This division led to a strategic victory by Tromp in the Battle of Dungeness in December. The English, meanwhile, failed to save the Mediterranean fleet, which was largely destroyed at the Battle of Leghorn in March 1653. The defeat at Dungeness demonstrated to the English that changes were necessary to gain the upper hand over the Dutch. The Rump Parliament responded by undertaking both immediate improvements and long-lasting reforms. Firstly, they agreed to a long-overdue increase in pay for the seamen. Secondly, the top naval command was strengthened with the appointment of two generals at sea, Richard Dean and George Monk. Both were experienced soldiers from the Civil War and were tasked with rectifying the indiscipline and lack of aggression that had been evident at Dungeness. George Monk, the Duke of Albemarle, born in 1608, came from the Devonshire gentry and had his first naval experience in the failed expeditions to Cadiz in 1625 and La Rochelle in 1627. He fought in the Low Countries, then in the Bishop's War in Scotland, and in the early years of the Civil War led his own Royal Regiment. He was taken prisoner by parliamentarians, and for 2 years his captors made every effort to convert him to their cause. Eventually Monk did switch sides. He fought with distinction in Ireland, where he caught the eye of Oliver Cromwell, and was then put in charge of subduing the last pockets of resistance to the Commonwealth in Scotland. Though ruling with an iron firmness, he maintained a good-natured tolerance of Scottish customs and religion. It took a major effort to provide the new commanders with a fleet strong enough to oppose Trump, and the English responded well, refitting ships and gathering provisions. More remarkably, the Council of State carried out fundamental reforms which were to serve as the basis of English naval administration for over a century. The central part of these was a new code of discipline, the celebrated Articles of War. The Dutch had effective control of the Channel, the North Sea and the Mediterranean, with English ships blockaded in port. As a result, Cromwell convinced Parliament to begin secret peace negotiations with the Dutch, although they made little progress. The Dutch, in spite of their successes, struggled to sustain a prolonged naval war as English privateers inflicted serious damage on Dutch shipping. It is estimated that the Dutch lost between 1,000 and 1,700 vessels of all sizes to privateers, up to four times as many as the English lost. In the first major battle of 1653, the three-day Battle of Portland, the English fleet challenged a Dutch convoy escorted by Tromp and de Ruyter as it tried to make its way home through the Channel. The English plan was to engage the enemy in the deeper waters of the western part of the Channel. The disadvantage was that the greater width in this area might give Tromp an opportunity to slip past them. In an attempt to avoid this happening, the English fleet zigzagged its way westwards. The Dutch commander had been delayed by latecomers and bad weather, so that he reached the mouth of the Channel on the 16th of February, and in an effort to make up time, continued sailing through the night. On the dawn of the 18th, lookouts on board Tromp's flagship sighted the English fleet off Portland Bill. The Dutch were surprised, but Tromp had kept his fleet well in hand, while the English squadrons were scattered all over the Channel. In his anxiety not to miss the enemy, Blake had perhaps spread his forces too thinly and placed them in grave danger. If Tromp acted quickly, he had the opportunity to destroy the English. Hoisting his red battle flag, he bore down on the enemy. Tromp came under heavy fire from Blake and his group, with both sides sustaining severe damage. The gunfire was clearly heard as far away as Portsmouth and the Isle of Wight. Fierce fighting occurred for a good hour until the squadron of George Monk was able to arrive on scene. Tromp was now seriously worried, having failed to secure or sink a single English ship. Monk attempted to break through the Dutch warships in order to attack the merchant ships which were further west. Tromp ordered his fleet to break off the action and to try to keep his warships between the English ships and his convoy. In the confusion, several badly damaged ships had to be abandoned before the onset of darkness brought the action to a close. The next day, fighting continued as the ship sailed steadily eastwards. As the Dutch desperately tried to reach home, they lost at least a further four ships. On the third day, the action resumed, Dutch resistance collapsing with one broadside from the heavier English ships, enough to put the enemy to flight. As night fell again, the English believed the Dutch were trapped. Yet Tromp used his expert knowledge of the waters to slip away and to reach the port of Dunkirk. Although Tromp had skillfully avoided total destruction, the Battle of Portland Bill had been a major Dutch reverse. Only 17 out of a total of 220 ships were still with Tromp. For the moment, the English fleet were in control of the channel, and Dutch convoys would be forced to revert to the longer northerly route around the tip of Scotland. The Dutch worked hard on restoring their fleet, but the battle had a dire effect on trade, the lifeblood of their economy. The English reforms of the navy were already helping bring success. Soon after the Battle of Portland Bill in March 1653, Robert Blake wrote the Sailing and Fighting Instructions, a major overhaul of English naval tactics. It contained the first formal description of the so-called line of battle, a tactic which revolutionised naval warfare and was used up until the 19th century. Here, a naval fleet of ships forms a line end-to-end, and compared with prior naval tactics in which two opposing ships closed on one another for individual combat, the line of battle had the advantage that each ship in the line can fire its broadside without fear of hitting a friendly ship. The success of this new formation was evident in the next major battle of the war, the Battle of the Gabbard Shoals in June 1653, east of Felixstowe, where the English fleet inflicted a devastating defeat against the Dutch in a long-range artillery duel. For the Dutch, heavy casualties in personnel gave a shattering blow to their morale, and the English followed up on their victory with a systematic blockade of Holland for over a month, paralysing all merchant shipping movements. Meanwhile, political tensions grew in London. Oliver Cromwell received rumours that the members of the Rump Parliament, fearing some form of military intervention, were preparing a bill for new elections, and also were planning to remove him from leadership of the army. On the 20th of April, Cromwell came into the chamber of the House of Commons and took his seat. After listening to one or two speeches, he stood up and angrily lambasted the members. Quote, "You are no Parliament. I will put an end to your sitting," end quote, he called out, and called in a group of musketeers to evict the MPs. Pointing to the parliamentary mace lying on the table, he declared, quote, "What shall be done to this bauble? Here, take it away," end quote. In the space of a few minutes, the rump of the Long Parliament was dismissed and England found itself without a legitimate government. Parliamentary democracy had been unseated by a military coup. There was remarkably little opposition to the move, and for a couple of months, no one was sure what was to come next. Cromwell set up a small council of state of 13 members, responsible for foreign policy and administration of the country. They decided upon a new assembly of 134 selected members, which became known as the Bare Bones Parliament, which met first on the 4th of July, 1653. Cromwell was not keen on the war and held discussions with representatives from the Dutch to explore the possibility of a negotiated settlement. Later, Cromwell's alleged failure to intensify pressure on the Dutch at this point was to be much criticised. Because of the English blockade, the Dutch meanwhile struggled to feed themselves without a regular supply of wheat and rye from the Baltic. Tromp believed it was imperative to break the blockade by force. The final battle of the war was the hard-fought and bloody Battle of Scheveningen on the 31st of July. The English fleet captured or destroyed numerous Dutch warships, and Admiral Tromp was mortally wounded early in the battle by an English marksman. The death of Tromp was a terrible blow for the Dutch, who regarded him as their greatest naval commander. However, despite the heavy losses of men and ships, the Dutch fleet was able to retreat, and the English had to abandon their blockade, so the Dutch achieved their aim. After the Battle of Scheveningen, the Dutch turned to using smaller warships and privateering, with the result that by November, Cromwell was anxious to make peace. Also, although the English were in control of the Channel and North Sea, the Dutch were still stronger than the English and the seas beyond. Cromwell had never been in favour of the war, and the fighting gradually petered out. In September 1654, a treaty was agreed by which the Dutch acknowledged the English flag in territorial waters and accepted the Navigation Acts. Compensation was agreed to be paid to English merchants, and the Dutch agreed to expel all royalist exiles from Dutch territory. Dutch politicians realised that the geographic situation of their republic would always make their mercantile economy vulnerable to English sea power. Nevertheless, the peace agreed by Johan de Witt was unpopular. The conditions included the so-called Act of Exclusion, which prevented the infant, William III, Prince of Orange, from being accorded the title of Stadtholder. The supporters of the House of Orange were forced to accept the situation, but remained a powerful force within the Republic. In England, some of the more extreme religious groups never forgave Cromwell either for arbitrarily dismissing Parliament or negotiating a settlement with the Dutch, but the majority population were relieved by the end of war. The English Navy, after an uncertain start, had refined its tactics and administration and achieved a convincing victory. However, the commercial rivalry between the two nations was not resolved. Especially in the emerging overseas colonies, hostilities continued between the Dutch and English trading companies. It was not to be long before conflict was renewed. You've been listening to a History of Europe Key Battles podcast. I hope you can join me next week for the continuing story of the Anglo-Dutch Wars. The music you heard was from the English Baroque composer Henry Purcell, an opera called The Fairy Queen, with a libretto based on William Shakespeare's comedy A Midsummer Night's Dream. And to finish off for today, I leave you with some music he wrote for a play called Abdelaza, or The Moor's Revenge.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.